Part 3. Noor. Your turn. Tell me a story, said Noor. They're lying in bed, Eleanor's body alongside Noor's, heating up her right side from her arm to her toes. She strokes or taps Noor's shoulder or face when she wants to make a point. Noor's trying to work out if she likes this or not. She thinks, yes. She does like it. Okay, Eleanor said. There was a couple who were in love. Then they broke up. Afterwards, the woman deleted the memory of the relationship without telling the man. Her name's Clementine, by the way. I can't remember his name. Clementine, said Noor. I feel like I've heard this before. Anyway, Eleanor said, the guy is really upset when he finds out Clementine wiped him, and so he decides to get his own wipe. I mean, fuck her, right? But then, halfway through the procedure, he realizes he's making a huge mistake. This machine is zapping his memories one by one, and he's trying to hide his memory of Clementine to keep it safe. What? That's not how it works. Shh. What he does is make up a new memory of the two of them together. They're at this place by the sea, Montauk, where they met. Hang on, Noor said. This is that film, Eternal Sunshine of the something. And why not, said Eleanor. I like that story. It's got a happy ending. Sort of. Has it? I never got to the end. I couldn't get past the science. I mean, they were trying to delete a long-term relationship. If that were possible, which it isn't, by the way, it would be a nightmare. Can you imagine? You'd be bombarded with hundreds of inexplicable things. Friends, slips of the tongue, small talk with dog walkers, Christmas cards from distant acquaintances, utility bills, the electoral roll, social media. And that would just be the outside world. That's not, said Eleanor. And that's just the half of it, continued Noor. What happens in your own head? Surely you wouldn't forget everything that had anything to do with that person. Years of your life would be blank. But then, if not, how do you remember the bedroom you shared, films you both watched, the holidays? Do you remember the country you visited, but when you try to remember the person next to you, the picture just fuzzes out? I feel that these are rhetorical questions to which you already know the answer, Eleanor said. The answer is no, Noor said. It's impossible, clearly. You'd go mad. Okay, Eleanor said. Never mind that. I think the main question is, can you really undo love? Can you undo heartbreak? Or do you think they'd sort of do something to you, leave something with you? I feel like you're asking these ridiculous questions just to provoke me, Noor said. They were both laughing now. Eleanor stroked Noor's face, slid her thigh over Noor's legs. Story time is over for today, she said. Noor isn't enjoying this memory. Fuzz out, she commands Eleanor. And Eleanor, surprisingly, does. She's replaced by Louise. Something Louise said to Noor years and years ago. What do you think is the number one least wanted memory among prospective Nepenthe clients? The type of deletion requested by a whopping 72% of the people that call the clinic? You guessed it. The memory of a past relationship. People come in and say they want what the guy had in Eternal Sunshine. The dream of Nepenthe lives on, whether or not any such thing exists. Noor has always taken pride in her professionalism. Everything she does properly. And so, when it comes to applying herself to the task of investigating the illegal behavior of her boss, mentor, and friend, Louise, she does it properly. She closes her door and sits at her desk with a notepad and a cheap pay-as-you-go phone that she bought at the supermarket last night. Noor knows from TV shows that this is a burner phone, but she refuses to call it that. She logs in as an administrator and goes back to the case notes of the people Louise called. Noor can't see all of them because Louise herself hadn't opened the case notes for every person. The last person Louise tried to call is a mystery. Louise hadn't looked at their case notes, only the clinic schedule for the first week of November before she made her call. Noor guesses that person has a procedure booked that week. And the call itself was to an out-of-service number, so that leaves Noor with nowhere to go on that one. Instead, Noor writes down the names of all the other people Louise called whose case details she can see. There are 8 of them. She can't look up their addresses, but she can see their names, the details of their local GP, their age, and job description. It's more than enough to find most of them on Google within the hour. She feels a small pulse of smugness, only for a moment, before the next moment brings the awareness that this list of people makes absolutely no sense at all. Noor wasn't really sure what she was looking for in the first place. Maybe she expected the people to be obviously connected to Louise somehow, or have something to do with Nepenthe, but they don't seem to have anything to do with anything. Least of all each other. There are a couple of executives, one at an energy utility, one at an arms manufacturer. There's a former soldier who left the army to set up a business making environmentally friendly cleaning products. A woman who appears to be a housewife in Kent. One person has served a prison sentence for fraud, but another is a solicitor. Noor looks at her notepad. She's not quite sure what the point of it was now. To write a list of names, apparently. Then to draw a large question mark next to them. She underlines the question mark. Then she looks at the phone, thinking, burner phone. Because she may as well give in to the inevitable. Noor is going to have to use this phone for something illegal and then throw it away. Tell me a story. But no, it wasn't like that. It wasn't even exactly a story. But it was the closest thing to a story Louise ever told Noor. And ever since Noor found out about the clients Louise and Noor had looked up. No, ever since Louise lied about the word rasa. Since then, Noor's been thinking about that story. Have you heard of Richard D. Rubin? Louise had asked Noor. It was a sunny day, back before the shutters had been installed. The two of them were sitting in Noor's new office, watching the reflected light toast the grass outside. Every now and again, a security guard would walk past, hand up to his face to protect his eyes from the glare. No, said Noor. Should I have? Not many people have, said Louise. He was really the first person to discover memory deletion. Except he didn't know that's what he'd done. His study wasn't seen as anything but a one-off, a curiosity. And now he's probably dead. That's unfortunate for him, said Noor. But when did he discover it? Back in the 70s, said Louise, before they tightened the rules about what you can and can't do with patients in mental hospitals. Rubin gave ECT to 28 people suffering from paranoia and hallucinations. Obviously, ECT is usually only given to anaesthetized patients, but Rubin kept his patients awake. He encouraged them to think about the things that frightened or disturbed them most. And while they were doing this, he shocked them.
What?
Said Noor. Why the hell did he do that? Well, it was known back then that ECT caused memory loss. A few hours, even a whole day. Reuben's idea was that if the ECT coincided with one of their active episodes, like a hallucination, the patient would just forget that they were mentally ill. It was insane, obviously, but as it turned out, nearly all of Reuben's patients saw a dramatic improvement in their conditions.
That doesn't surprise me, said Noor. I'd dramatically improve too if the alternative was going through ECT again, fully awake.
Louise leaned forward. She said, But you see why it worked.
Sure, said Noor,
always trying to please teacher.
I guess he interrupted the memory of their fear or delusion and stopped it from reconsolidating.
Yes, yes. Louise waved a hand to forestall any more explaining. We know that now.
But people didn't know about memory reconsolidation for decades after that study. They had no idea what was going on with the neurons.
Okay, said Noor warily.
Louise had leaned back again. Her face blinked out, turned dark against the window behind her. But Noor had the feeling that Louise was looking at her the way she'd looked at Noor in her job interview only a few weeks before.
What do you think about that study? Louise asked.
Well, said Noor, I feel like my answer is going to end up being unintentionally revealing of my ethical beliefs, whether I'm a moral absolutist or a relativist. And that also, if I answer, it could lead to more questions that are harder to answer until we end up with a thought experiment like the trolley problem, which I don't have anything against, but honestly, I've gone over that so many times, I'm quite happy to let them all die under the trolley, even the ones who weren't in danger in the first place.
Louise smiled.
And, she said, and so I'd prefer not to answer, if that's okay with you.
Of course, said Louise.
Listen, what are you doing this Saturday? I'm having a party. I think you should come.
Which was good and bad. Good because Noor knew she'd passed the test by refusing the test, and she felt an immense, almost painful, need to pass a test set by Louise. But also bad, because now she was going to have to go to a party.
Noor opens her notepad. On one page, she's written what basically amounts to a script. It's a little different from the usual Nepenthe script. Hi, goes Noor's script. Am I speaking to... insert name. Great. Hello, insert name. This is Laura Honeywell from the Nepenthe Clinic. This is just a follow-up call, as I understand you've already spoken to Dr. Nightingale. As I understand it, Dr. Nightingale has discussed your upcoming restoration with you, and you made the decision to cancel? Would you mind taking part in a brief feedback survey over the telephone? It should only take 5 minutes and is designed to help us tailor our treatment to our client's needs going forward.
Wonderful. First question.
Except it doesn't ever get that far. The executive at the energy utility says he hasn't spoken to Dr. Nightingale. Not at all. Never heard of her. The former soldier, flustered, has heard of Dr. Nightingale, but only because she was the one who conducted his wipe. And when Noor expresses surprise that he can remember anything about the procedure, he hangs up. The arms manufacturer executive hangs up immediately.
The person who has served a prison sentence for fraud says he won't be speaking to anyone from Nepenthe without a solicitor present. The solicitor says he won't be speaking to anyone from Nepenthe at all, let alone Laura Honeywell. That is her name, isn't it? And what is her job, if he may ask? Who exactly authorised this call? The Kent housewife, Barbara Key, is the most surprising. By the time Noor gets to, "This is just a follow-up call," Barbara interrupts and says, "Journalist, is it?" "What?" Noor says. "No, it's fuck off," says Barbara, and hangs up. "Interesting," thinks Noor. She circles Barbara's name a few times, slowly. Then she looks her up again. It turns out that Barbara is the wife of a former East End gangster, now in prison. Barbara wasn't implicated in his crimes, and so she kept her six-bedroom house in Sevenoaks, new Range Rover, and ownership stake in a wine bar called Grape Expectations. It feels like a significant discovery. Noor just doesn't know what the discovery means. She draws some more question marks on her notepad. These marks deeper than the first, more darkly scored. She'd like to push these people further. Prod, pry, provoke. Whatever it takes to get something illuminating out of them. They might not be good people. A number of them, at least, are definitely criminals. But the fact remains, they're clients. She has a responsibility towards them. Maybe Louise's actions have already made duty of care a lost cause, but there might still be something to protect. Noor doesn't know how much they know or how vulnerable they are. They could be victims, not co-conspirators. So she can't mess with them too much. What next? She opens a new page in the notebook. Noor only ever went to one of Louise's parties in the end. The news that she was invited caused envy and consternation among her colleagues, none of whom had been invited to Louise's large, expensive house, let alone any of her parties. Noor could have told them not to worry. It only took one party to establish that Noor was happier not attending Louise's parties, and she imagined Louise was happier not having her there too, because there were no more invitations after that. Why this? Why this particular memory? Is it because she's been wishing for the Eleanor memories to let up, and so now she has to be punished with something that's almost worse? The walls of Louise's house were white, and there were a few sofas scattered around. The tall windows looked out onto a garden that was lit up with floodlights, firing the undersides of the trees. It reminded Noor of Nepenthe. Not in any way that she'd ever seen it personally, but the way it must look to the self-confidential clients arriving at night. She allowed herself a nostalgic thought of her own office. Noor inside, door closed. Louise, or her husband, seemed fond of Japanese woodcuts of mountains and villages and the sea. There were a lot of them on the walls, lit up with tiny spotlights. Noor became quite fond of them herself. They allowed her to stand in front of them with her untouched glass of champagne, pretending to be deep in contemplation. Every now and again someone would approach her and make conversation, and she'd try to look like she was happy that they'd done this. She tried, but she could tell, they could tell, she wasn't quite sincere. "So, how do you know Louise and Alistair?" asked one man. His name was Bob Rathbone. He was actually very pleasant. He asked her about her working relationship with Louise, and Noor was glad to have the chance to say something with sincerity. She told him that Louise was a kind of mentor, that Noor was very grateful Louise had seen something in her, despite Noor not having much of the right kind of experience. "Well, that's Louise's gift," said Bob. "Knowing when to go by the book and when to read between the lines. I imagine you're the same." "Oh no," Noor said. "Not at all. I'm a coder, really. If the lines don't cover every eventuality, I believe they need to be rewritten." "Exactly," Bob said. Then, Noor was almost sure,
He winked. At that moment, Louise appeared at Bob's side and asked to borrow him for a moment. Noor was grateful for the interruption. The conversation hadn't been bad, but winks? She didn't know what to do with a wink. It was exactly the kind of between-the-lines interaction she thought she'd been very clear about not liking. Alone again, she noticed that one of the windows to the garden was actually a door and that it was slightly open. The air coming in was warmer than the air inside the house. It was perfumed, too, with moss and roses and faint wood smoke. She slid the door the rest of the way open and went outside. The garden went back a long way. Noor found herself out of the range of the floodlights, and still there was no end in sight. What exactly was she doing, anyway? A little further off, she could make out what looked like a white, vaguely human shape under some trees. As she got closer, she realized it was a figure of a girl, floating above the lawn. She'd never believed in ghosts, but that didn't seem to matter. She was about to meet one. Her heart rate hurried, but she carried on walking. Noor still isn't sure why she did that. As she got closer still, she realized the figure was a real girl, about 12 years old, sitting on a swing. She remembered that Louise had mentioned she had a daughter, adopted when she was a baby. A clever girl, according to Louise, but fragile. Something like that. Louise had looked suddenly uncertain when she said this. Noor hadn't seen that expression before or since. "Hi," Noor said to the girl. "You look like a kid in a horror film. Didn't anyone ever tell you not to sit on swings in the dark late at night? You could give someone a heart attack." Noor was looking at the girl with curiosity. She couldn't have imagined Louise wanting a child so much that she'd source one from another country. But here she was, a sweet, soft-looking girl in white pajamas with a blunt fringe and a ponytail. "Sorry," said the girl. "Is your heart okay?" "Seems to be working," said Noor. "What are you doing out here?" But as she said it, the out here enveloped her. The warmth of the night, the smell of the slightly damp grass. And there was an owl hooting, which was ridiculous because this was London and surely owls were extinct here. At this distance, the lights of the house and the people moving silently inside looked beautiful. There was something almost poignant in how beautiful they were. It was obvious why the girl was out here. May, she remembered. That was Louise's daughter's name. "I'm seeing what it feels like to be an outcast," May said.
"You're what?" said Noor.
"My mum's always saying if I don't stop doing X or start doing Y, I could end up a social outcast. So I'm seeing what it's like, because I might decide not to do what she says and just be an outcast."
Maybe not so soft after all, thinks Noor. She can see more of a resemblance to Louise now.
"Right," Noor said. "Except then you're not really an outcast. You can't cast yourself out."
"I can," said May.
"No, I mean, it would be called something different if you chose to walk away." May smiled. "An outwalk," she said. Noor was watching the house. Louise had come close to the window now. She was talking to someone, smiling and moving her hands. For the first time, with the sound taken away, Noor saw that Louise wasn't quite like the other people around her. As if Louise was there, talking and laughing and entertaining, but also she wasn't. She looked at Louise again. Louise looked totally normal. Still, Noor didn't feel like going back to the party. So she said goodbye to May
walked back down the garden, left via the dark side entrance of the house, and went home, gratefully, to bed. Later, Noor understood her own mistakes at the party. She'd been too obviously insincere, then too sincere. She should have been perfectly insincere, sardonic, jokey, and light. She should have behaved like Louise's drunk but charming husband Alistair, joking that every time he won an argument, Louise wiped his memory, referring to Nepenthe as the brain drain. Noor didn't find that one funny. She was surprised that Louise would tolerate it, actually. But Louise just raised her eyebrows and smiled. And then later, Alistair made a joke that Noor thought Louise definitely wouldn't have found funny, which might have been why Alistair said it quietly to a friend of his. The friend was as drunk as Alistair. Neither of them had noticed Noor standing near them, pretending to inspect the art. They were talking about investments. "Thanks for sorting out the KL property," Alistair said. "That was a good shout." "Any time," said the friend. "How about soon?" said Alistair. "You know how Louise's income is. We can't keep up. It's like a fucking oil well. What are they called? Geezers? Gushers?" The friend said something crude then, and Noor moved away before they realized she was there and felt embarrassed. Though she thinks now, they wouldn't have been embarrassed. It wasn't the friend's joke that really irritated Noor. It was Alistair's laugh at his wife's expense. He was obviously the one with the money. Noor had checked out the payroll at Nepenthe, an early hack, and Louise, while on a decent salary, wasn't rich. There was clearly no way the two of them could have afforded the house in London and Alistair's Maserati and the overseas property on her income. Noor thought it was tasteless of Alistair to draw attention to this inequality. She wondered why Louise, never knowingly tasteless, would marry a man like him. What Noor admired about Louise, more than anything, was her infallible judgment. She didn't want to admit Alistair into that picture of perfection. She didn't want to have to think about Louise. What the hell was she thinking? So she just didn't think about it. Noor calls up the clinic schedule for the first week of November. She makes a note of the people who are supposed to come in that week to have their bad memories put back into their heads. M. Lewarn, M. O'Connor, W. Hall, O. Levy. She clicks through to the case notes for each of them, one by one. There's nothing unusual about them. She realizes M. Lewarn's appointment is actually a follow-up, with their actual restoration taking place the week before. So Noor rules this person out on the basis that if Louise was trying to intercept them, she'd have been looking at a different calendar page. None of the others have cancelled their restorations yet, which makes sense, as they're still in the calendar. She can't work out which of them might have been that last person Louise tried and failed to call, the one with the disconnected number. She gets to O. Levy. There's something strange about these case details. When Noor clicks on his or her name, an error message pops up. Access denied. She tries again but gets the same result. "Huh," she says. This is something she hasn't ever seen before. She looks up the call log again, before she remembers that she won't be able to see the number Louise tried to call, as it never connected. "O. Levy," Noor writes in the notebook. ? And of course, the problem with Louise not getting through to this person, who has to be O. Levy, surely, is that Louise will probably try to contact this person again. She will probably expect Noor, unwittingly, to help her with that. Noor isn't sure how she's going to get out of that one.
It would be reasonable to suppose, thinks Noor, that this mystery about what Louise is up to would be Noor's uppermost concern right now. Because of course it should be. Clients could be at risk. The company's reputation would definitely be at risk. Louise could lose her job. Noor could lose her job. Criminal charges? Prison may not be out of the question. And yet, that's not the case. It's like when children wonder if there'll be enough love to go round when a sibling arrives, and the parents say, love is not finite, or something to that effect. It turns out that worry is not finite either. The disturbing thoughts about Louise haven't supplanted Noor's disturbing thoughts about Eleanor. Rather, her worry has expanded, embracing them both. It's Noor's own fault. She knows how neural pathways work. She's the one who started thinking about Eleanor again. She's reinforced the pathway over and over again. The more she thinks about Eleanor Dark, the more she thinks about Eleanor Dark. Until the most tenuous things remind her of Eleanor Dark. And some of them are really fucking tenuous. Like a glass of wine, and there she is. Puff of smoke. Red or white. Or spirits. Or a pillow. Noor looks at the empty pillow, and there's Eleanor, throwing herself back, laughing. She sees her young neighbours walking through the park, talking and laughing. Yesterday they were arguing, something about decisions. Just insane, the girl said. Why? Why would you want that? The boy kept saying, but I have to, I can't not. It ended with a fuck off and a door slamming at 2 a.m. Now they're arm in arm. The whole thing looks exhausting. Noor finds herself pausing, turning, as they dawdle past. They don't see her. They're engrossed in their own conversation. But she feels embarrassed and annoyed, seeing herself watching them. The neighbours are nearly at the park gate when they stop and draw together in a kiss. The girl's arms wrapped tightly round the boy's neck, the boy's hands pressing into the denim above her arse. All this totally in the way of people using the gate, of course, nor will somebody to walk into the park and tut at them. Nobody does. And what am I doing? Noor thinks. Is this who she is? A disapproving old bag at the age of 36? Hanging around parks in order to get her fix of outrage? Is that it? There's a low vibration of pain in her stomach that says, that's not quite it. Maybe it's that, admit it, something about the girl reminds Noor of Eleanor. She's smiling. She gestures with energy. She throws the full length of her body into a kiss. But there's a look she has, surfacing again now as the two of them disentangle and walk out of the park, that seems somehow fatalistic. It's not exactly the right word, nor doesn't know the right word. Something like being in the epicenter of happiness, knowing that this happiness won't be around long, but making peace with that. Eleanor often had that look. And there she is, Eleanor, saying, what would you get rid of if you had to get rid of a memory? No idea, was what Noor had said. Something from childhood? Pressed Eleanor. You can't delete anything from childhood, Noor said. Childhood is too far back, too woven in. Nepenthe doesn't usually delete things if it's been longer than 6 months. The longer you wait, the more chance you'll have talked about it or thought about it in the interim. And what happens then? Eleanor asked. You get fuzzy patches. That's not the scientific term. That's how people often describe it. So if you deleted something very integral, very early, a lot of your life would be a fuzzy patch. They'll be able to one day, I bet, Eleanor said. delete childhood. So, theoretically, would you delete anything from yours? Well, theoretically, ethics would prohibit. It's very obvious when you avoid personal questions, by the way, Eleanor said. You get very academic. What do you want? Noor said. A tale of woe? Well, my childhood was ordinary. That's it. And it's true, she thinks. It was an ordinary kind of bad. Nothing startling, nothing original. Noor was gay and an atheist. Her family were straight and religious. It wasn't a good mix. Eleanor looked at Noor for a while. She said this carefully. Do you think it's fair to say you aren't a very open person, Noor? Absolutely, said Noor. Being open isn't the same as being honest. I think honest is important. Open, not so much. Especially in the modern sense, when it's most often used to justify rehashing one's traumatic past endlessly and usually unproductively. Right, Eleanor said. Noor doesn't say that sometimes she'd rather Eleanor was less open. Noor doesn't know how to respond to the confidences Eleanor drops on her without warning. First of all, Noor deals with that kind of stuff every day in her professional life. Talking about it out of hours is like bringing work home. Secondly, she can't even respond as she would at work, neutral, detached. There's a pressure on her to be warm, empathetic, even to give up something personal of her own. She never trained for that.
The second time they spent the night together, Noor was about to go off to sleep when Eleanor said, I thought I was done with all this. Sex. I've been celibate for over a year, since the helicopter accident. What's awful is, when I saw them taking Guy away, what came into my head was, that's a mistake I won't be making. I mean, I was always getting drunk or bored or lonely and sleeping with people. I might have slept with Guy, if he'd caught me in the right mood. It's pretty cold to think that when you're looking at someone's dead body, though, isn't it? You were probably in shock, Noor said. Noor really didn't want to hear about Guy. She didn't want to hear about any of the people Eleanor had slept with when she was drunk or bored or lonely. I did mean it, though, Eleanor said. At that point, I started to get sick of sex. I got sick of other people, which is stupid, because how can I blame other people? It's not like they're one homogeneous mass. I mean, it's my fault for being attracted to the wrong type of people. Noor wasn't sure what to say to this. In case you're wondering, Eleanor said, you're the right type of people. She rolled over to face Noor and smiled. One breast had slipped out from under the sheet. It was velvety and full. The nipple was a pale salmon pink, a tender, almost painful softness. Noor had never seen another woman's nipple so close. It was like an unblinking eye. She didn't know how to meet. Open, she thought. One door closes, another door opens. Noor, closed. Eleanor, open. Eleanor was so open, it was frightening. Hang on, Noor thought later, after Eleanor had gone to sleep and couldn't be asked. How can you remember the accident? Noor isn't one to dwell on past failures. Granted, access has been firmly denied to the clients Louise phoned, and to O'Leary, and before that, to an explanation of Rasa, something she thinks now must be connected to the phone call somehow, if only because it's clearly secret and it also involves Louise. But one thing Noor has learned from that innocent time when she worked with computers rather than people is there's always access. One way or another, there's always a way in. The same does not go for people. Noor waits until she gets home to begin implementing her plan, more accurately, the last of her plans. She's got no idea what to do if this doesn't work. She gets onto Google and searches again for Nepenthe and Rasa, looking for the forum in which a poster, Total Wipeout 73, mentioned the two in connection. Some theory about robots with human memories. She finds it, then scrolls through the rest of the threads, reading about MK Ultra and Illuminati and Wouter Basson and Area 51 and what this might have to do with Israel, the Queen, fluoride in the water, genetically modified weaponized ravens, before she thinks, that's enough. She sets up her own blog with an amateurish font, a few stills from the Terminator films, and a disjointed but passionate diatribe about the web of lies and corruption at Nepenthe, and calls the whole thing Truth About Rasa. Then she goes back onto the forum and tells Total Wipeout 73 that he's mostly right, except for a few crucial details, and posts a link to her new blog. When Total Wipeout gets there, he's going to find that the truth about Rasa is that Nepenthe are taking human memories to implant them into genetically modified ravens. She's even included a few lines from the Poe poem for extra credit. It doesn't matter if Total Wipeout 73 agrees with Noor or not about the ravens. She plans to talk to him if she can, but if not, she'll be able to get his IP address as soon as he visits her webpage. And then she'll be able to find out if he was once a Nepenthe client and how he got hold of that word, Rasa. It's 2 p.m. Noor's interviewing her last client of the day. After this, the trial period of the new script ends, and so does Noor's contact with the general public. The prospect of paperwork and management duties never seemed so sweet.
"I feel like I've meddled with something I shouldn't have," says Noor's client. "I tampered with my own memories."
"That's a very common feeling to have after the procedure," Noor says.
"Really?" asks the client.
"Let me tell you about the Phelps study," Noor says. "It's very enlightening. We think our memories are pure and uncorrupted, but this is a delusion. Every time we access a memory, we rebuild it. Every time it's rebuilt, things are added and things are lost. In fact, the more we remember something, the less resemblance that memory bears to the original event. We know that memory is fallible, or we know it, but we don't really believe it. If someone says we remembered something wrong, we argue over it. We fight for the honor of our memories. Maybe it's like religion or love. The more flimsy something is, the more fiercely we believe in it."
"So this is Phelps," the client says. "Phelps says this."
"Not exactly," Noor says. Let me restate that." She manages to get things back on track, but after the client has left, on time for once, she thinks, "Well, Noor, what the fuck was that about?" It's been a few weeks since Noor saw Louise. This is unusual. Louise usually visits Crow's Hill every week. Noor's not sure what to make of her absence. At the end of every day, she's relieved that she hasn't seen Louise, but every day her dread of Louise's inevitable appearance is sharper. The clinic is busy these days, bordering on chaotic. Nobody was able to accurately predict how many of Nepenthe's self-confidential clients would end up going through with a restoration. A couple of hundred, so far, think that they will. 237 people have replied to say,
I'd like my memory back. I don't want my tonsils, my appendix, my tumour, my rotten right toe, but I do want this. There are new staff members arriving, people training them, people carrying equipment into offices and therapy rooms, people filling up the kitchen. It's nearly impossible to avoid people. Noor's been having to make small talk all week. One of the main perpetrators of the small talk is Dr. Carini de Oliveira, who has taken an empty office in the opposite wing of the clinic to Noor's. Carini's got the job of comforting and calming the clients who get their memories back. She has a convincing smile, maybe even a real one. She's very warm and approachable. Noor doesn't approach her. Carini drinks fennel tea, and Noor's heard she does yoga in her office, so she already knows they have nothing to say to each other. And the busier the clinic gets, the more resonant Louise's absence is. After three more days go by, Noor goes to the clinic director, Jim Stokes, to ask if Louise's visits have been postponed while the restorations go ahead.
No,
Jim says. He looks alarmed.
Louise alarms him. Are you expecting her?
No, Noor says. I'm just organising my diary. She won't be coming in this week then, you think?
I have no idea, Jim says. She used to put her visits in the system. Lately, she doesn't turn up for them, or she arrives at different times. I have no idea what's going on. Actually, I thought you'd know. You tend to know more about her visits than I do.
Noor imagines Jim saying this to the board members. Dr. Ali was the only one who spoke to Dr. Nightingale. I had no idea what was going on.
I wish that were the case, she says quickly.
Dr. Nightingale's schedule is a mystery to me too, a complete enigma. She smiles. Jim looks confused. Maybe she shouldn't have smiled. The best thing to do is behave normally, which in this case would be what? No smile, a short nod, and I'll let you get on. Yes. And with that, she's out of Jim's office, thinking, thank God normal Noor isn't a small talk person. Around this time, it occurs to Noor that maybe Louise hasn't got another way to contact the person she's looking for, O. Levy. Maybe there's only one phone number on the system and no other way to track this person, which would mean that Louise doesn't need Noor to co-authorize another view of the same client contact page, which is why she hasn't bothered coming in. But what she might do, what would make sense for her to do, is to come to the clinic instead on the day of O. Levy's appointment and speak to him or her in person. And what will Noor do then? Total Wipeout 73 won't speak to Noor, as she expected. She sends him a PM under a different name, but he's immediately so suspicious of her that she starts to worry she might be putting him under too much stress and stops. She doesn't really need to talk to him anyway. She's got his IP address now, has found his real name, Nigel Potter, and looked him up in the Nepenthe system. He's another access denied. Noor feels elated by this discovery for at least 3 seconds. That's about as long as she gets to celebrate each breakthrough before realizing every breakthrough makes the whole picture harder to understand. There's not much else Noor can do with Total Wipeout 73/Nigel Potter. As a former Nepenthe patient who says he's lost several years of his own life, he's hardly going to be able to remember anything useful. She writes a question mark under his name in the notebook. But something else potentially interesting has come out of Noor's blog. About 20 other people have followed the link to it, and the very first person to click is someone who works for Nepenthe.
From the speed of the click, whoever it is must have a keyword search alert set up, the words being Rasa plus Nepenthe. Unfortunately, the IP address covers the whole of Nepenthe's London headquarters, so the visitor checking out Noor's blog is one of hundreds of possible employees. And the Nepenthe IP is so guarded against hackers, there's no way Noor could get any more information about the specific user. Is this you, Louise? Noor wonders at her laptop. What are you up to out there? She goes through the rest of the people that followed her blog link. It doesn't take her long. Most of them have a loudly troubled online presence, with the focus of their rage falling on things like blood-drinking celebrities, crop circles, and so on. They don't care about Nepenthe, particularly. But then she sees one social media profile she recognizes. In fact, it makes her flinch, a delayed physical reaction. It's the protester with the Rasa cover-up placard. She remembers the beard, the grey hair, the antagonistic look in his eye. Last seen glaring behind a large globule of his own saliva, travelling towards Noor's face. Noor is delighted to see him. Martin Noy is his name. His profile is private. The only other picture of his she can see is a black Labrador in the back of a Volvo estate. Noor creates a fake social media profile of her own. She puts a lot of care into finding a photo. Attractive blonde in her 40s, dressed neutrally in a shell pink blouse. Who could spit at this woman? Noor thinks fondly. She names her Isabel Blanchard and gives her two golden retrievers and a farmhouse in Cornwall. Isabel requests Martin as a friend. Martin accepts. Hi, Martin, Isabel messages. This sounds weird, I know, but I have something I was hoping to talk to you about. Privately, I mean. To do with Rasa. Can we talk over the phone? It's not even a minute before Noor's burner phone is clattering on the desk. She's a little taken aback. She picks up. Hello, she says, in what she imagines is an Isabel voice. I know what you're doing, says Martin Noy. He seems angry. Already? I'm sorry, Noor says. You must think I'm stupid. If you know about Rasa, you know about the non-disclosure. You think you're going to catch me out that easily? I'm not bloody stupid. Do you understand me? One day, your bosses are going to get found out and then they'll be fucked. Like they fucked me, and that means you get fucked too, you lying bitch. Martin hangs up. The sound of his furious voice seems to leave the phone slowly, as if the handset is gradually cooling. Well, you really ruined that one, Noor says to Isabel, deleting her. She goes back into the system and looks up Martin Noy. Access denied. What? Noor says under her breath. Bosses, she thinks. Multiple bosses. Non-disclosure. Whatever Rasa is, more than one person at Nepenthe is involved. Which she should have suspected sooner, because it's not like Louise sent that message to herself. Up until now, Noor has had only one vague theory. More of a hope than a theory. She knows Louise doesn't like Clifford Byrne, their head of operations, and Louise's immediate boss. Louise also doesn't like the damage that restorations could potentially do to vulnerable clients. It's not like the memories can be removed again. It was tried with rats, and the results were not promising. Nor does Louise like the way Nepenthe has ignored the issue of traces, staying stubbornly silent, refusing to investigate, even though everyone knows they exist. And Louise doesn't like the way clients who develop mental illness are effectively shut out by Nepenthe. And Noor agrees with Louise. She agrees with her about traces and restorations and Clifford and basically everything else Louise has ever said. And so Noor's been wondering if this admittedly very serious wrongdoing on the part of Louise could perhaps have an underlying reason that Noor, too, might agree with. Unfortunately, while Noor thought restorations were just something she and Louise bitched about together, maybe Louise has decided to stop bitching and start phoning clients to warn them they're making a terrible mistake. The problem with that theory is this. Why Louise would only try to talk a tiny handful of clients out of getting their memories back. Louise has had hundreds of clients over the years. Why these few? Noor had come to assume that the access denied clients, Rasa, and Louise's phone calls were all part of the same wrongdoing on Louise's part. But now it's clear that while Rasa definitely has something to do with the access denied clients, and Louise has something to do with Rasa, Louise hasn't called any access denied clients, only the usual kind. Nor is there any sign Louise tried to contact either Nigel or Martin. And so there's no reason to think that O'Levy was the person Louise was looking for on the clinic schedule. Noor is embarrassed by her own bias. She's assumed that Louise was only keeping one secret from her. And why? Because she finds it painful to believe that Louise is involved in separate misdeeds. As if Noor can perhaps handle the personal betrayal of Louise having one secret, but two is just too much. When rationally, if Louise is breaking one rule, she's probably broken more. Anyway, Noor has to assume that Louise could have been looking up one of the other people due to have a restoration that week. She looks up their names again. M. O'Connor? W. Hall? There's no way to find out. Ugh, Noor mutters. She rubs her scalp, as if she can massage the answer out of it. Another problem is why Louise would knowingly implicate Noor in whatever it is she was up to. It might be that she believes so passionately in whatever she's doing that she expects that Noor would want to help her. But then, why not tell Noor about it? Noor has to admit that there's a strong possibility that Louise isn't as good a friend as Noor would hope. That maybe do least harm doesn't cover Noor quite as comprehensively as Noor would like. Please no, Noor thinks. Even though it's too late for Noor to be pleading with Louise. Whatever Louise is doing, she's already done it. So what exactly is she pleading for? Noor can't sleep. It's been 2 hours and she's been thinking about Eleanor, then Louise, then Eleanor, then Louise, and so on. She's getting pretty pissed off with the pair of them. But then she thinks, it's hardly their fault. Come on. Eleanor Dark? Louise Nightingale? No wonder they pop up at times like these, when the curtains are drawn. Noor gets up. She takes another sleeping pill. She doesn't read the fold-up paper instructions that come with them. What's the worst that can happen? She never wakes up? Boo fucking who? Her thoughts slow, but they don't stop. The Eleanor Louise roulette wheel spins, ticks to a stop, lands, finally, on Eleanor. Eleanor was asleep in Noor's bed. Her eyes were closed. Her gaze dancing about under the lids, off roaming other lands, with other people. Eleanor never had any problem sleeping, not even under a strange roof. She'd slept soundly the very first night she'd stayed. Noor hadn't actually been sure if Eleanor would want to stay, or if Noor wanted her to, but Eleanor settled the matter by falling suddenly, deeply asleep. That was 6 months ago.
and Eleanor had stayed more and more often since then. She'd been here now for a couple of weeks. Noor still wasn't sure how she felt about this either. She got in carefully next to Eleanor, who, unusually, woke up and put her arm over Noor's shoulder. Her skin was warm. "How is it you can remember the helicopter crash?" Noor asked, switching off the light. "Oh, right," Eleanor said. She sat up and rubbed her eyes. For the first time, she looked evasive. She said, "Look, it wasn't exactly the crash I had deleted. It was the stuff around it. Some circumstances that it was better for me to forget."
"Okay," Noor said. She was trying to work out what she wanted from this conversation. If she really pushed Eleanor, Eleanor would more than likely tell her that she had been sleeping with her boss, because what was a memory of circumstances, if not a memory of context? The context being that Eleanor and her boss must have been having a relationship. His death upset her so much that she was celibate for a long time. She must have wanted to make the memory of him less painful. Maybe she'd erased the day he told her he'd leave his wife, presented her with an engagement ring. Or maybe it had gone the other way. He'd dumped her and she couldn't bear to remember it. "Do you want to talk about it?" Eleanor asked, and now she sounded hesitant.
"No need," Noor said. "I just wanted to check there weren't any procedural issues."
"Of course you did," said Eleanor. She laughed, but her laugh didn't sound very happy. She said, "I thought for a moment there you might have some personal reason for asking."
"Sorry," said Noor.
"So as we're awake and talking, can I ask about your work? For my own personal reasons?"
"Okay," Noor said warily. "You got very prickly the other day when I said about you getting in so late, so I dropped it. But I'm curious. You work crazy long hours. You're always talking about Louise and your work. It all seems very devoted. Did you two used to date or something?" Noor was shocked.
"Absolutely not," she said. "Christ, I don't see Louise like that at all. She's been a mentor to me. I admire her. I don't want to have sex with her."
"Oh, so the two things can't go together. You don't admire me."
"I didn't mean that."
"Okay, don't be offended. You're just obviously committed to your work, that's all."
"I am committed about my work," said Noor. "And to Louise, too. She's trying to make the world a better place. That's what I want, too. What you need to understand about Louise is..."
"I've met her, remember?" Eleanor said. "She didn't seem all that amazing to me. But I'm glad she inspires you."
Noor was annoyed by this. "Don't you want to be inspired by a job?" Noor said. "Are you going to get another one of those, by the way?"
"I got a lot of compensation from the crash," Eleanor said. Her arm had retracted. Noor hadn't noticed when that had happened.
"Fine. But if you did something you loved, maybe you wouldn't be here all day focusing on me, noticing what time I get in. I mean, you can do what you want. It's just a suggestion."
There was a long pause. After a moment, the sheets moved around Eleanor's shoulders. Noor, facing the dark ceiling, guessed that Eleanor was shrugging.
"Okay," Eleanor said. "Maybe we should get some sleep. You have work tomorrow."
"Okay," Noor said.
"Night."
"Night." A growing coldness across Noor's collarbone, where Eleanor's arm had been.
When Noor woke up, Eleanor was gone. Noor sits at her desk, half her attention on the sliced-up view, wondering at what point the slices of Louise's Tesla are going to slide silently in under the slices of the pines. I'm not ready, she wants to say. I need more time. Because if Louise arrives now, she's going to look at Noor and know that Noor's worried. Which puts Noor at something of a disadvantage. The memory wheel spins. Louise is up this time. It's 4 or so years ago. Louise's hair is longer. It's hot outside. There's a weeping fig in the corner of Noor's office, still alive. Louise was talking to Noor about something, and then she stopped, looked at Noor closely, and said, "What's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong," Noor said. "Don't lie," Louise said gently. "You're a decent liar usually, but being in love makes you obvious. You should know that about yourself." "Love?" said Noor. Louise laughed. She said, "It might shock you, but you behaved exactly the same way everyone else does when they fall in love. You gazed through things. You smiled more. You looked softer. You didn't sing, though I honestly thought you were about to at times. Then you took a week off work. Now you look terrible. So, what happened?" "You and I don't usually talk about personal matters," Noor said. Louise just looked at her. "I got involved with a client," Noor said. She hadn't really been planning to say it, but that was what she said. It was said now. Noor looked at Louise, not in terror or relief, but an exact midpoint between the two that felt strangely like calm. A stillness descended. She felt limp, placid, like she'd given up on survival and let herself float out to sea, allowing whatever happened to happen. Possibly the first moment in her life that she'd done so. It was just a shame that she was allowing her life to be ruined. Louise, for the first time, looked surprised. "That was unexpected," she said. "So, you fell in love with a client. What, after you did her final interview?" "Yes, I met up with her after that. It's over now." "I can see that," Louise said. Her eyebrows were returning from the heights they'd just scaled. "I know that makes no difference," Noor said. "I mean, my career's over in any case." "Oh, for God's sake, Noor," Louise said. "You didn't do anything wrong. I know there are rules, but rules have to make way for common sense from time to time. The clients are almost out of the door when they get to you. You assessed this woman objectively, right?" "Right." "You won't see her again in a professional capacity. The way I see it, no harm done."
"The main concern is if she's likely to make a complaint or say something publicly."
"No," said Noor. "She wouldn't do that."
Noor couldn't tell what she was feeling now. Uncomprehending. A second ago she'd been floating out in the sea. Now she was back on land, towed back by Louise. Louise bearing her weight, Louise's arm round her neck.
"I can't ask you to keep a secret for me," Noor said. "This is serious. You could get sacked just for knowing about it."
"So don't tell anyone that I know about it," Louise said. "Problem solved."
"But," said Noor.
"Stop," Louise said. "Stop being so noble."
"Okay," Noor said.
Thank you."
Louise moved across to Noor, patted her shoulder, and said, "These things happen. I mean, you probably never thought these things would happen to you personally, but it did. You got involved with someone and it ended. Welcome to the world of everyone else."
"It's shit," Noor said.
"But anyway, you're in that world and you're having a great time."
Louise laughed. Is that what it looks like? She said. I suppose I don't talk to you much about my family. Well, I'm divorcing my husband. My daughter is also experiencing some issues, unrelated to the divorce.
Oh.
God. I'm sorry, Noor said. She didn't say, I don't know why you married your husband in the first place. She remembered May sitting in the darkness on a swing, talking about being an outcast.
I had no idea, Noor said.
You weren't meant to, said Louise. I met May once, said Noor. A while back, at your party. She was only 12 or so.
She's 16 now. She's not very resilient. I worry about her.
I'm sorry, Noor said again. Your husband,
Oh, Christ, don't be sorry, Louise said. She looked at Noor. Then she laughed and said, Oh, yes, you met Alistair. You're wondering what I saw in him.
Well, Noor said, maybe.
He was a lot of fun in our 20s, Louise said, and good looking. I didn't see it as a problem that I never really took him seriously. Then he ended up not being a serious person. Not that that's my responsibility.
Of course not, Noor said.
Then she thought, but...
Noor'd noticed over the years that the things Louise believed often ended up being true. And it made sense. Louise's perceptive eye naturally covered the future as well as the present. But she was also reminded of the reason experiments are double blind, to prevent researcher expectations influencing the results.
Anyway, Louise said, I've had unrequited university crushes that hurt me worse, much worse. Maybe that's the key, the newness of being hurt. The first is the worst. After that, it's just routine.
Thanks, Noor said. That's depressing, but also quite helpful.
Well, good, Louise said.
I'd rather not talk about this again, if that's okay.
Fine with me, Louise said. We'll go back to not talking about personal matters.
And that, as Noor remembers, is what they did. With everything else that's going on, Noor's plan to ask Louise to help her erase the memory of the very end of her relationship with Eleanor has been pushed back, almost forgotten. What's stupid is that she'd been dreading asking, but she sees now how simple it would have been. Do you mind conducting the procedure? As I can't tell anyone else how the relationship started, is all she would have needed to say. And Louise, as Noor's friend, would have said, no problem. But is Louise Noor's friend? The thing is, Noor thinks she is. She's just not sure why. Maybe Louise is only Noor's friend so she can know where Noor's bodies are buried. Or to have a useful person to blame when the phone calls come to light. Or both. She was a bad egg from the beginning, Louise would say at the inquiry. First, the affair with a vulnerable client. Then the illegal calls to clients trying to sabotage the restoration program? I suppose I do bear some responsibility for allowing her too much free rein. Oversight procedures will be examined, I can promise you that.
What did you do, Louise?
Noor whispers this at her desk to an imaginary Louise opposite. The imaginary Louise being a lot easier to question than the real thing.
Why did you break the rules?
Rules have to make way for common sense, says Louise.
Did you do it for something good or something bad?
Stop being so noble, says Louise. Don't tell anyone. Problem solved. She pats Noor on the shoulder. No harm done. Noor looks up the clinic schedule again. The first week of November is nearly here. She checks all the four people who are coming in. Nobody has cancelled. She takes out the notebook. She shouldn't keep it in her bag, really, though it's not like anyone else would be able to make much sense of it. Noor herself hasn't made any sense of it. It's covered in question marks, underlined question marks, three or more question marks in a row. What is RASA? Why did Louise prevent only a small number of people from getting their memory back? Why are the clients lying about speaking to Louise? Who is Louise looking for now? Has she already found them? And then the other questions, written at the back, that have nothing to do with anybody. Why did Kirk? How did Orlando? What did Clementine? Questions. Questions. A philosophy lecturer Noor knew told her once that philosophy wasn't about answers. It was about asking questions. He said this like it was a good thing. Noor thinks, I need to do something about this notebook. She burns it that evening in the log-burning stove she never uses, leaving the door open, which makes her cough. She's got all the questions memorized anyway. And when she goes to bed, her hair lying around her face, smelling of smoke, the questions come back. They circle and swoop. Why is Louise lying? What is Louise going to do next? In less than 2 weeks' time, the people on the schedule will be arriving at the clinic. M. Lewan, W. Hall, M. O'Connor, O. Levy. Noor knows Louise is spending the rest of this week in Manchester. After that, Noor expects Louise will be back at Crows Hill. She'll be running out of time at that point, but she won't be able to let that haste show on her face. She'll arrive in Noor's doorway, looking carefully cheerful and calm, and then she'll try to intercept a restoration. Which means that, without knowing what she's preventing or why she's preventing it or how she's going to prevent it, Noor is going to have to do something to prevent that.